The United States Court of International Trade is now in session. The Honorable Gary S. Katzmann presiding before Court Number 24-00014, United States versus Kola Oberpuch. Will the attorneys please state their names for the record, starting with the plaintiff?
Good knowledge, the United States.
John Wood for Kola.
Alexandra Kretikova, U.S. Customs and Border Protection.
Edward Kenney, U.S. Department of Justice for the Government.
Anna Hayes, also for COLA.
Good afternoon. Please be seated. We are here on plaintiff's motion for alternative service. The court has received the filings in this case, both the plaintiff's motion for alternative service, the response in opposition by the defendant, and the reply by the plaintiffs in support of their motion for alternative service. And the court, of course, has provided questions for oral argument. So the parties have a sense of, not that they need our help in any way, regarding the questions that are interest in this very interesting case. And I will state at the outset that, as is my practice, I will provide the parties with an opportunity to file a supplemental post-argument submission, not to exceed 1,250 words, and that would be due on next week is the 4th of July week, of course. So that would be due on July 3rd. Just wanted to provide you with that advance knowledge. And the parties will be given 20 minutes for their presentations. And we will begin with the plaintiff, Mr. Mathis.
Thanks, Your Honor. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'll just jump right into the questions, if that's all right. Starting with your first question here, you've asked whether we have a primary target here for service between Steptoe and Holland and Knight. At this point, our primary target would be Holland and Knight, as they filed a notice of appearance in this case indicating that they're representing the defendants here. Their notice of appearance state that they want all papers served on them, so they would seem to be the primary target here. But I should emphasize that the analysis under Rule 4E3 is going to be the same whether it's Holland and Knight or Steptoe. And the reason why is because the rule just asks whether service through alternative means here, through counsel, is prohibited by international agreements and whether that service is consistent with due process. And from our perspective, whether it's Steptoe or Holland and Knight, both of those are met here. There's no international agreement with Germany or in Germany that would prevent service through a law firm as a conduit. And as we mentioned in our papers, due process is satisfied because both firms have a current connection with these defendants. Steptoe currently represents the defendants as plaintiffs in Montre Americas, as you know, and obviously Holland and Knight is here today representing the defendants. I believe also that Mr. Wood represented one of the previous entities, Kohler entities, in the anti-dumping cases that led to these duties that are at issue in this collection action. So there's also an additional connection there, but not when he was at Holland and Knight. So that would be our response to question number one. In question number two, you ask...
So it's your position that the essentially that the defendants have made your life easier here by through the appearance of Holland and Knight?
You know, maybe slightly easier, but I think it would have been the same had they not appeared. You know, the key fact is that they are currently representing the defendants. There's a current line of communication between them and the defendants. So I suppose, yes, it does make it slightly easier. But we don't think that the absence of a notice of appearance would have made a difference. The second question here is, assuming that Rule 4E refers to the place of service and not to the location of the individual or entity to be served, the first question is, would USCIT Rule 4D apply instead? And 4B asks whether, if so, assuming that Holland and Knight is an agent authorized by appointment to receive service, could the government serve the defendants by delivering a copy of the summons to Holland and Knight without seeking the court's leave? The answer to both of those questions is yes. Assuming that Rule 4E3 wouldn't apply to using a law firm as a conduit for service on a foreign defendant, we would agree with both of those. I just want to caveat that by saying, you know, our position is that, you know, every court of appeals that addressed this question of a law firm serving as a conduit for service has concluded that it's proper under the district court analog to USCIT Rule 4E3. So you'd be in good company concluding the same. It's only a minority of courts that have concluded or agreed with Convergen, the Southern District case.
Convergen is the opinion authored by Judge Lyman?
That's right. That's right.
And was that decision appealed?
I'm not sure. That's something I can add to my supplemental submission. I'm not sure if it was appealed. Mm-hmm. I will say, though, I have the list here. The circuits that do agree with our position are the 9th, the 10th, the D.C. Circuit, the 3rd Circuit in an unpublished decision, and also, of course, the Federal Circuit, which was applying 9th Circuit law in nuanced communications. Mm-hmm. Those decisions aren't necessarily binding in the sense that they're interpreting the federal rule of civil procedure rather than the USCIT rule, but obviously the language is the same, so we think that the analysis should come out the same way. Mm-hmm. That being said...
To your knowledge, has Convergen been cited approvingly?
I know it's been cited disapprovingly in Mervick, which is the case that we cited at length in our opening brief. I'm not sure if it has been cited approvingly. I think in the Southern District, I think Judge Lyman might be on his own on that one. Mm-hmm. It seems that the consensus, at least in the Southern District, is that alternative service through counsel as a conduit, comports with the plain language of Rule 4. F3 there, mm-hmm. That Rule 4E.
I'm curious, and this is sort of a frolic and a detour question, but as you know, here in our court, Court of National Trade, we have an advisory committee which provides guidance and advice on the local rules. Within the Southern District of New York, is there an advisory committee that where the question of Convergen Energy has been presented to that advisory committee?
That's another one I unfortunately don't know the answer to. I'd be happy to look into that and get back in the supplemental submission.
Yeah. As I say, it's a frolic and detour question. So
it's certainly a valid question, and it may well have come up in a local rule discussion. Obviously, the federal rules as a whole, there's a different committee that addresses those. But I'll take a look into that and see if I can find anything.
Right.
As to question 4B, I just want to quickly address that. You know, assuming that 4E doesn't apply here, we would agree with the court. And, you know, it's a close issue, but, you know, this notice of appearance that asks that all papers be served on Holland and Knight in connection with this case, we do think that that constitutes an appointment for receipt of service by the defendants. And, I was able to find at least one case that concluded that similar language in an entry of appearance satisfied the 4D standard for appointment. And that case is Brown versus Peterson. It's in the District of Alaska. And just give me a moment, I'm sorry. The site is 2005 Westlaw 697506. And we'll include that in our supplemental submission as well.
Thank you.
I'll just read very quickly from that. This is in footnote 3 of the decision. In that case, it was an entry of appearance which stated that the attorney requests that he be served with copies of all pleadings and documents at his office, and the court concluded that that made clear that the attorney was an agent authorized by the appointment or by law to receive service of process on behalf of the defendant. There are many cases that will say that simply showing up as an attorney and defending a client in litigation does not waive objections to service of process, and that's certainly true. But that waiver question is obviously separate from the appointment question. And we think that this language in the notice of appearance, although it's in a form, quite clearly is an appointment to receive process. But again, our position generally is that 4E3 is the correct route for effecting service through counsel here because of the defendant's location in Germany. As to question three, you've asked, in our view, if there's any way that Holland & Knight could have entered an appearance in this case without establishing itself as a viable conduit for alternative service on the defendants. So I think I might have addressed this a little bit before, but our answer to that is not really, because the fact that is crucial here is their current representation and communication with defendants. That's all that's required for due process. And again, the rule only asks for 4E3, I'm talking about at least now, the rule only asks whether there's a prohibition by international agreements. And of course, as the cases have said, whether there's a due process problem. Mm-hmm. So again, the entry of appearance, is, the notice of appearance, excuse me, isn't necessarily the deciding factor. But if you're asking under 4D2C, obviously, then yes, we do think that there could have been a way that they could have crafted this notice of appearance mm-hmm. to avoid the appointment issue. They could have said that they haven't been appointed, for instance, to receive process. Mm-hmm. That may have been an option, although I will say that that sort of limited appearance is something that they would have to get approval from the court.
What is the difference in, as you characterize that, you know, sort of a limited appearance and a special appearance?
Right. So the rules have abolished the distinction between general appearances and special appearances or limited appearances. I think as the courts use the phrase, what they mean is that there's some sort of restriction on the counsel's representation of the defendant in some way.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I think, that's what I mean by limited service, limited appearance, excuse me. So, you know, we are here simply, for instance, a typical example is might be if an attorney shows up to represent a defendant for purposes of mediation or settlement only, that sort of thing. You wouldn't typically see this, I don't think, if it were simply, you know, we're defending this client, but just don't serve anything on us. That doesn't seem like the sort of limited appearance that an attorney could enter. I haven't found an example of that. As I said, the more common example is, you know, limited purpose, for instance, representing a pro se as standby counsel or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
As for question four, and I might sound like a bit of a broken record here, I apologize, but in the government's view, is there any way that Steptoe could have conducted its email exchange with the government to reach the same agreement without establishing itself as a viable conduit for alternative service on the defendants? And my answer there would be the same. Again, it's the fact that they're in current communication with the defendants that makes them a viable conduit. So the only thing they could have said in that email communication, if it were true, is, you know, Kohler has fired us. They won't talk to us anymore, so please try somebody else. And you can see in the email communication, the attorney from Akin Gump basically said, I'm not the right person to contact. Go talk to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
That might have been an option for them to say, but at the very least, there would have had to have been some sort of statement that I am not in current communication with the defendants. Regarding question five, you've asked to assume that the court adopts an inclusive standard for determining when a law firm's actions render that firm a viable conduit for alternative service on a defendant under Rule 4E. How might a law firm effectively represent a client that seeks to avoid service if the fact of the representation itself could result in service through U.S. counsel? So the short answer to that is a law firm can still effectively represent a client and object to service or object to proposed service, just as Holland & Knight is doing today. They can make objections to the fact that, for instance, maybe an international agreement prohibits service in the way that it was attempted or the way that the government has proposed. They can object and say that the method of service might be inconsistent with due process, for instance, if we propose service by publication or something like that. But, you know, avoiding service, I don't think that that's a legitimate thing that counsel can advise a client to do. You can certainly object to service that's been attempted. You can, like I said, object to a method that's been proposed, but avoiding service isn't exactly a legitimate defense.
What is your home run case for that proposition?
I think my home run case would be the Mullane case, in the sense that the point of service of process is simply to provide notice to the defendants of the case that's been brought against them and an opportunity to object. And under the rules, of course, service of process, objections to it, they're disfavored, they're waived if they're not raised at an earliest possible opportunity. So I suppose there's not a case directly on point that says a lawyer can't advise a client to evade or to avoid service. That might raise ethical questions, but as far as for the purposes that we, of this motion today, I think it suffices to say that there is a possibility that hiring a lawyer, if you're a foreign defendant here in the United States, will make that lawyer a possible conduit for service. That's not necessarily a problem, though. If the defendants were avoiding service anyway, there are plenty of cases. We've cited one, Gamboa, in the Eastern District of Michigan, where service by email is an acceptable alternative, even with Germany. So that is an alternative, and I'll get into that in a second. That is another possibility. So the defendants would be in the exact same position in terms of trying to avoid service, whether they hired U.S. counsel or not. If anything, this just incentivizes them to hire U.S. counsel to make the objections that they can while still holding the government to a proper method of service. So from our perspective, yes, it may subject that counsel to being a conduit, but it doesn't really change the equation too much for the defendant. And as to that last question, could the government serve defendants via email? Our position is yes, we could with a Rule 4E3 order. That would be required before we could do that. But yes, that's an alternative that's been ordered before. It was ordered in Gamboa, as I mentioned. I don't have the cite for that case off the top of my head, but
Gamboa,
G-A-M-B-O-A. It should be in my table here. It's 2019 Westlaw 8378038. That was from the Eastern District of Michigan. And in that case, the plaintiff asked for both email service on the German defendant and also service through counsel as conduit. And the court at first ordered email service, then the law firms that came back and said, no, please serve us instead. And that's what the court ordered on reconsideration. So we've moved to serve counsel simply because we think that that would be more convenient for the defendants. But if they would prefer service through email, it's something that we can do. Kohler has a generally accessible email inbox. It's info@kohler.com. We could serve them through that. And that, of course, would avoid all of the interpretive issues that there may be with Rule 4E, because that would certainly be service that occurs abroad and not simply service that would be made on an individual.
So if I might ask, why haven't you done that?
We don't think that we need to. We think that we're pretty solid on Rule 4E3 as it is. We think that the cases are pretty much in our favor, but if the court were inclined to find against us on that, that's certainly something that we would move for an order on. And that's, we can either put that in the supplemental submission, or we can simply renew our motion if the court disagrees with our reading of Rule 4E3. But we think, again, it's the better reading. It's the reading that the majority of courts have adopted, and certainly the reading that has prevailed in the courts of appeals.
With respect to the German District Court, could you speak to the ruling of the German District Court here?
Sure. And I don't speak any German, so I'm relying on what the translator says here. But it did say, it's a request to try service through diplomatic channels. And we interpret it just as that, as a request. I mean, the rules contemplate that a central authority in a foreign country may request an alternative method. That's in Rule 4E2. I can't remember off the top of my head, but it's 4E2 something. It talks about the request that's made by a foreign authority in response to a letter of request or letter of rogatory. So the rules contemplate that that's one alternative. And it
now,
treats
letters
as...
letters rogatory are fairly common.
Sorry?
The use of letters rogatory.
Yes.
Fairly common.
It is, I'll say, with a country that is a signatory to the Hague Convention, it's not as common because the Hague Convention supplants the letter of rogatory process. But yes, it is a method that's used. It is a much slower method, as the State Department estimates it can take a year or more. And it does actually require judicial intervention. You would have to sign letters rogatory before they could go to the State Department and then be forwarded to the German authorities. So in terms of your work, it's about the same. Mm-hmm. You're still going to have to sign something that says these letters will have to go somewhere.
Right. In terms of the proceedings before the district court, and I will ask the defendants for further information on this, to what extent were the arguments presented to that court that this was not a matter where diplomatic channels are required or take any kind of precedence?
So as I understand the question, you're asking if whether in any proceedings before the German district court?
Right, yeah.
So I should clarify, as far as this service request goes, basically what happens in this Hague service arena is that we translate the complaint and the summons and these request forms, and then they're sent directly to the German district court where the defendants are located. It covers the area where they're located. The German district court, my understanding is it's sort of like a quick determination that's made on whether the service request can be honored.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not really a proceeding like we would think of it. It's really just a sort of pro forma, does this meet, check all the boxes? If not, then it gets sent back.
Mm-hmm.
And the box that we weren't able to check is the fact that this is, under German law, a public law matter rather than a civil or commercial matter that's the subject of the Hague Convention. I know that there were proceedings in that were mentioned in one of the cases we cited, which was United States XRL Bunk from the Eastern District of Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
This is an issue that's been litigated in Germany before.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not as familiar with that litigation. That typically comes up in cases where you have a private plaintiff that's seeking to enforce a government right, like a False Claims Act suit.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not familiar with any proceedings that would have occurred here.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as diplomatic channels are concerned, that, as we pointed out in a reply, really is just a formal system of communication,
mm-hmm.
not diplomacy. It's just a matter of routing the request through the right channels to get to the right person, and really it's just going to delay service rather than anything else. It's not going to affect any different form of notice.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that would impact is our ability to enforce a judgment in Germany,
mm-hmm.
and that's not something that we would be able to do anyway, given there's common law that prevents, it's called the revenue rule. So this is a revenue judgment that we're seeking. So even if we were able to get better service, under Germany's eyes, it wouldn't make a difference for us. I see my time's almost expired. If there's anything else you'd like me to address, otherwise I'll sit down and listen to what Mr. Wood has to say.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm John Wood on behalf of the two defendants, Kohler Oberkirch and Kohler Paper. As a preliminary matter, I want to make clear that I'm appearing for the limited purpose of objecting to the government's motion for alternative service. I have not been authorized by my clients to accept service of process of the complaint in this case. The two parties have cited dozens of cases regarding motions for alternative.
Has transpired here. It's not as if the government has walked over to you with papers to be served.
I'm joking.
That's a bad joke.
The two parties have cited dozens of cases regarding motions for alternative service of the process. The names of the defendant's counsel are available in those cases. Yet not one of those cases cited in either party's briefs did the court so much as suggest that the appearance for purposes of objecting to alternative service constituted a waiver or consent to service of the process of the complaint. Indeed, such a rule would make it impossible for defendants to object to alternative service. The notice of appearance form signed by defendant's counsel is just that. It's a form. Rule 75 says that it has to be in substantially the same content as the form provided by the court. So we really had no choice but to sign it in order to make an appearance for purposes of objecting to service the process of the complaint through alternative means. Counsel intended to consent to receive electronic copies of future filings, not consent to service the process of the already filed summons and complaint. A similar form, in fact, was used in many of the cases cited in the briefs. One example of that is the MAO-MSO case cited in our brief. We have a copy of the notice of appearance. We're happy to submit that with our supplemental filing. But it simply cannot be the case that counsel cannot enter an appearance for purposes of objecting to alternative service without at the same time accepting service by doing so. Indeed, counsel needed to appear to make the important, and in this case decisive point, that service on U.S. counsel is not permitted by USCIT Rule 4E. That rule provides that an individual, quote, may be served at a place not within any judicial district of the United States, unquote. By its plain terms, the rule does not allow services within a judicial district of the United States. Here, the government seeks to serve counsel, whether it's Steptoe or Holland and Knight, in the District of Columbia, which is obviously within a judicial district of the United States. The fact that the party to be served is outside of the United States is of no moment, because the rule refers to the location of the place to be served, not the location of the party upon which service is sought. That's the holding of the conversion case, which you mentioned in your questions, and many others holding that Rule 4 after the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure is not available for service of U.S. counsel. Now, this is a question of first impression for this court. As counsel for the government pointed out, there are two Federal Circuit cases addressing this, but neither of them applied Federal Circuit law. In Nuance Communication, the case relied on a Ninth Circuit case that upheld alternative service of process. And in the In Re OnePlus Technology case, that was actually a mandamus case that said that there was no Fifth Circuit law contrary to Nuance Communication, and therefore the standard of clear and indisputable had not been met for purposes of mandamus. If the court disagrees with our argument that alternative service is not available under USCIT Rule 4E, then the question is whether the government has made some showing of the need for judicial intervention. And that's language from the Convergent case and many others. Here, there is no need for
the Convergent case and many others. Now, counsel has commented that, you know, Convergent is an outlier, that you've heard the argument, you've read the filings by the plaintiff, saying that the positions that you're advanced has not received support from any of the other courts, other circuits.
The Convergent case is not an outlier. We cite several cases supporting Convergent in our briefs, and Convergent itself, as well as the other cases we cite, in turn cite other cases. Now, the government has said that the Convergent case is a minority position. I don't know numerically which position has more cases supporting it, but it's fair to say that both positions have a substantial number of cases supporting them. In this case, there's no need for judicial intervention here where service through diplomatic channels is available. In response to your honor's question number two, there's not a strict hierarchy among the subsections of USCIT Rule 4E, just as there is not a strict hierarchy among the subsections of Federal Rule Civil Procedure 4F. Nonetheless, the cases uniformly state that international comity requires some showing of a need for judicial intervention before alternative service of process will be ordered. Here, the interest in international comity is heightened where the foreign court, the District of Freiburg, has explicitly stated that the government should pursue diplomatic channels for service. We cite a long list of cases that hold that alternative service is not appropriate where other means that respect international comity are available. The cases state that typically courts permit service upon domestic counsel when either the address of the foreign defendant is unknown, the foreign defendant has evaded service, or failure to permit such service will result in a long delay affecting the case, such as if there is a discovery deadline or a trial approaching. None of those factors is present here. The government knows where to find Kohler. Kohler is not evading service. A few months delay in service would not harm the case. The contrary, this case is about sales of lightweight thermal paper from 2009 to 2011. The government has waited several years to bring this case, and there are no proceedings in the case that would be affected by a delay of a few months while service is made through diplomatic channels. In contrast, the cases cited by the government generally involve defendants who could not be located, such as fly-by-night companies, defendants who evaded service, or some event in the litigation, such as a discovery deadline or trial that required alternative service. For example, in the In Re South African apartheid litigation, there had been an attempt to serve under the Hague Convention that had been pending 6 years before the U.S. court authorized alternative service. In the TFT-LCD flat panel antitrust litigation, this was an MDL where one plaintiff would miss out on a coordinated discovery if it couldn't use alternative service. And in the Mahl versus Kirch-Gessner case, the discovery deadline and trial date were, quote, steadily approaching, unquote. No such concerns are present in this case. With regard to the court's question 3A, whether USCIT Rule 4D regarding service of an individual within a judicial district could apply, That rule does not allow service on the defendants here because the defendants are not within a judicial district of the United States. Rule 4D does not have an alternative service of process provision the way Rule 4E does. And Rule 4D cannot be used to serve defendants' counsel because, as I've already argued, defendants' counsel is not authorized to accept service in this case. With regard to your Honor's question number one, would Holland and Knight's receipt of the summons provide notice to defendants and afford an opportunity for defendants to present objections? That question appears to be a question about whether the due process standard would be met by alternative service. Here, Kohler is not making an argument about due process. Instead, we argue first that service on U.S. counsel is not consistent with USCIT Rule 4E, as I've already explained. And second, if the court disagrees with us on that, then the government has not made a sufficient showing that judicial intervention is necessary. That's an additional step beyond the due process requirement. In response to your Honor's question four regarding whether the District Court of Freiburg's request could be read as a statement that the possibility of service through diplomatic channels precludes Hague Convention service, but not all other means of service, the District Court did not rely on the existence of diplomatic channels as the reason to deny Hague service. Instead, the Court for Freiburg said that it was not a commercial or civil matter. Instead, it was public or administrative law, and therefore Hague service was not available. The court nonetheless went on to request that service be through diplomatic channels. On the principles of international comity, that request should be honored, particularly here where defendant's location is known, defendant has not evaded service, and there's nothing in the case that requires immediate service through alternative means. In conclusion, we respectfully request that the court deny the motion for alternative service.
Let's assume hypothetically that diplomatic channels were attempted here. What would be the, hypothetically, would there be a basis through diplomatic channels to, reject your contentions?
I don't know if there's a basis through diplomatic channels for rejection of service. To my knowledge, the civil or commercial requirement for the Hague Convention does not apply to diplomatic channels. So I'm not aware of any reason why the government here cannot use diplomatic channels successfully. I do think there's an opportunity to potentially have meaningful dialogue between the U.S. government and the German government regarding possible resolution of the case, which would be ideal for all parties.
And when you say resolution of the case, what do you mean by that?
I think that the German government, possibly the Ministry of Justice, could encourage the United States to try to settle this case and make the point that $193 million is more than the government needs to receive for a very short duration of transshipment.
Now, of course, there will be the argument on the other side that sort of that intervention might itself be in some ways intrusive of United States interests.
Well, that's really what diplomacy is all about, is an exchange of views between the two countries. And so that's why diplomatic channels is appropriate and should be used before alternative service of process.
What is your home run case regarding diplomatic channels?
Well, there are many cases that we cite in our briefs. I say certainly the conversion case is our home run case on the Rule 4E question. I would say Tucker versus InterArms from the Northern District of Ohio, which is a lawsuit against a Brazilian company for alleged defects in a firearm. And the court held that the plaintiff must obtain service of process by letters rogatory, even if that is not the exclusive means of service because of international comity, and held that international comity benefits both the foreign forum and the domestic forum.
Okay.
But that's not to suggest that that case stands alone. There are many cases we cite in our briefs for that proposition.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. So that concludes our argument, although since you're all here, I give each side an opportunity to speak further for not more than 2 minutes. Mr. Mathers is jumping up. Yeah.
Yes. Thank you for the opportunity. I'll be brief. Council mentioned a number of times international comedy. I just want to emphasize that we're not just talking about the United States interests as a whole. We're talking about this court's interests and the Federal Circuit's interests, because this court upheld the anti-dumping duties that are at issue in this case. The Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit upheld both of those decisions, and the Supreme Court twice denied certiorari. So it's not about how much money we think we are entitled to. It's about how much money this court has said the United States is entitled to. And I think that you're hearing today again that the defendants hope that service through diplomatic channels will be a negotiation rather than the formal process of notice that it is really supposed to be. That's all the more reason to order service through alternative means. I just want to emphasize one more thing. Counsel said that the government has waited several years to bring this case because these imports are from 2009 to 2011. I just want to emphasize that obviously there's a lot of litigation between that point and the time that liquidation instructions went out by Commerce and that bills were issued by CBP. That started, I believe, in 2018, and after that process, the defendants protested those bills. They largely lost those protests. Then those protests became final and conclusive. Rather than tendering that money and filing a case in this court to further challenge it, they instead siphoned away 75% of their assets to a newly formed parent company, Kohler Paper SC. So we've moved as fast as we can after negotiations with Kohler went nowhere, and we're trying to move quickly here so that further assets aren't dissipated or moved away, and so we're not playing this shell game of who we now need to serve. So I just wanted to make those points known. I know it's already in our briefs, but just emphasizing that we're not sitting on our rights here. We are trying to move as quickly as possible because we are talking about, at this point, over $200 million worth of revenue that the government has been deprived of, and that were intended to level the playing field for the paper industry. So, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Wood?
Yeah, I would just emphasize, Your Honor, that there has been litigation regarding the anti-dumping duties imposed by the Commerce Department, but that litigation, all the way up to a petition for cert at Supreme Court, ended several years ago. That's not to say that the government has waived anything or that they should be punished for their delay, but simply that they can't come to this court and claim that there's a need for this to be expedited through alternative service rather than go through the method provided by the Court of Freiburg, which is diplomatic channels. And out of respect for international comedy, we respectfully request that this court deny the motion for alternative service and require service through diplomatic channels.
I understand your point, I think, and also Mr. Mathers, but I think Mr. Mathers is suggesting that insofar, Mr. Wood, as your client is suggesting that this is a matter that's appropriate for negotiation in terms of the amount of monies that are owed or due, that those are issues that have already been resolved through the American courts, and that is not subject to further discussion at this point.
Well, there's no reason why it can't be negotiated. There is a final judgment regarding upholding the anti-dumping duties that went up to the Federal Circuit, but there's no reason why the two governments can't still have a negotiation regarding an appropriate amount to pay for a very short duration of transshipments.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes our argument, and I'd like to thank counsel for your very fine presentations. As noted at the outset, we'll provide counsel with the opportunity to file a post-argument supplemental submission of not more than 1,250 words, and that will be due on July 3rd of next week. So without any further, comments, the court is adjourned, and safe travels. Thank you.
All right. Court stands adjourned.